From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, I want to talk about microphones. I'm not a microphone connoisseur. I mean, the little handheld mic that comes with the radio I get is usually fine with me, but I know that in some cases I'm kind of selling myself short, aren't I?
Well, it is kind of surprising in a way, because most, I hesitate to say all because I know of some that are not provided this way, but almost all HF transceivers and VHF transceivers that we buy come equipped with a microphone, and they're usually the type you describe, a handheld microphone with a push-to-talk switch on the side. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason you can't use it. And by the way, it has the advantage that you know it'll work with that radio, which isn't always the case with other microphones. It's designed to work with that radio, and everything's compatible. And that's just kind of perhaps surprising to some that there are perhaps more microphones out, different kinds of microphones, than there are radios out there.
An astonishing number.
And if you've been in this for a while, you end up with, as I have and probably many others have, a drawer full of the microphones that come with the radios, and you end up with using something else. Why is that? Well, and by the way, some of the push-to-talk hand mics have even more functions that we should mention, because not all the other choices do.
That's right.
Some have buttons to allow changing frequency up and down as you drive or whatever without having to reach for the radio. They may have, used to be fairly common that they would have a dual tone multi-frequency, some would call it touch tone pad on the microphone to access repeater phone patches, which since the days of cell phones.
What are those, Joe?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be. I resisted buying a cell phone for many years because I had my DTMF pad on my mic, and the local repeaters all had auto patches, and I could call home from the road for free that way. Didn't have to pay a phone bill. But I think that's all gone. You don't see them too often anymore.
No.
But they're still useful, by the way. The control operator or repeater can use them to cause the repeater to do different things remotely by entering in particular numerical codes.
So having a DTMF touch tone, or what we call touch tone,
yeah,
microphone would come in awfully handy.
It would for some people that have that particular requirement. And I guess I should say touchtone, I think, is an AT&T copyright term, which is why we use DTMF, which is the more generic thing. But it's the same concept. Now, why wouldn't you want to use that microphone at home also? It's certainly the right thing to use for most people on the road. And that's what you see on the road is people using handheld mics that come with the radios, usually. Well, there are a couple things about it. One is just convenience. For me, if I'm operating phone and I have a handheld mic, when I'm done talking, I tend to put it down on the desk, pick up a pen, and start writing or something. And then when it's my turn to talk again, I have to shuffle under all the papers and find the mic and chase it off the edge of the desk and pick it up again and make it work. And then hopefully it's still my turn. So I think that's one issue. The other choices of microphones tend to be those that are sort of stay put, either on a stand in front of the in front of your face, so you just point at it and talk, or on a boom arrangement that's tied to your desk that you can swing out of the way when you don't want to use it. And another that's very popular is one that has a small boom on the headphones that allow you to swing it down into your in front of your mouth, and then it stays in the same position no matter which way you turn your head. You always have the microphone in the right place, which is I find very handy for contesting. So that solves the problem of chasing the microphone around the desk, but it doesn't solve all the other problems. For example, the desk stand type, many of them have a push-to-talk arrangement. Generally, the ones that are on booms, which I should say is what we're talking on right now in our studio.
That's right, yes.
And the ones that are on headphones, the headsets, typically don't have built-in provision for push-to-talk. So that means you have to do something else to cause that to happen. And there are choices for that. Most sideband transceivers provide a voice-operated transmit capability called VOX, VOX, which switches to transmit as soon as you talk into it. And that's one solution. Another solution is to use a hand switch, which can you have to chase around the desk just like the hand mic. So it's really not gaining much on that, I think, unless you have it fixed in some place. Or a foot switch. Now, at my station, I don't have a fancy mic on a boom such as we have here. I do have a mic on a desk stand with a push-to-talk, which I use for casual operating. And I have a headset with a microphone on it, and I use that with a foot switch. And at times, I've had it actually fixed to the knee hole of my desk and actually use it as a knee switch, which is...
I've never heard of that.
Well, it actually works well. The problem with a foot switch is sometimes you find it's gotten kicked under the desk, and you have to go chasing after that, just like the mic on top of the desk. It's even harder to find. For a while, I had some Velcro hook and loop fastener stuff holding it to my floor, and where this thing is now, I have a rug there, and I guess I could use a Velcro hook arrangement to catch that. Actually, the rug is gone now. It's now a smooth floor, so I have to hook something to it, but I still find I can find it readily well, and it works fine for me with the headset. So those are kind of the mechanical parts of the question. You know, what do you like to work with? What's comfortable for you to interoperate with? But there's another aspect to it, and that is actually two other aspects here. One is the acoustic properties. Now, oftentimes when you're talking to somebody using one of those little hand mics that come with the radio, somebody will say, you sounds like you're talking on a hand mic.
Yes.
I guess they have their own characteristic sound, which I guess is not quite as pleasant and full as many other microphones, but it certainly allows you to be understood, and whether it's important for you to sound good as well as being understood is a personal preference, I guess. So some of them have the housing of the microphone and the element arrangement such that the acoustics are better. They also can be directional. Many of them are directional, and what that means is typically they have a front-to-back ratio, just like a Yagi. So if the back of it is pointed towards your radio, you can reduce the pickup of things like your fan motors, and also it helps with the Vox, anti-Vox arrangement that you don't hear your own speakers as well into the microphone. So that makes it easier to make all that stuff work.
Is that the microphone pattern that you so often see? I'm going to mispronounce this. Cardioid?
Yes, cardioid. That's a cardioid pattern, which is also, you see that in the antennas. The typical classic antenna is a pair of vertical monopoles spaced a quarter wave apart and fed 90 degrees out of phase. Now, I don't think the microphones do that, but the pattern is about the same. It has a fairly deep null to the rear and a fairly wide acceptance range on the front, which is sort of what you want for a microphone. You'd like to have the rear down a ways. And that's good. You know, if the cat is behind the microphone too, that's good because then you don't hear the cat as well. So that all helps. So that's another aspect is the acoustical properties of the different kinds of microphone. Now, unfortunately, there's a third consideration, which is the type of microphone element that's in the mic.
Oh, I'm glad you're going to get to that. I was curious about that.
Because that's actually changed over the years. We transitioned from vacuum tube to solid state over, I would say, the 1960s to 80s kind of thing. And there's, of course, still vacuum tube, as we've talked about. There's still vacuum tube gear out there. My Drake transmitter and receiver are still running just as well as they did in the 70s. But in the vacuum tube days, the microphones were designed to work into a high impedance load, the grid of a vacuum tube, basically, an impedance in the megohm, millions of ohms range. And what the microphones for those radios were typically crystal cartridges, piezoelectric crystals, and some were dynamics. The dynamic element itself was low impedance, but they typically had a transformer in the housing that transformed it to the high impedance that wanted to drive the radio. So early microphones of that ilk do not work well with modern transceivers and transmitters that are have input impedances of about 600 ohms, typically, or lower. Current microphones are designed to drive 600 ohm line kind of thing, which is sort of the telephone company audio standard. And in most cases, if you take a crystal microphone and drive into that load, it will get very thin sounding and be very low level and won't work, basically. I mean, that's kind of...
Oh, yeah. I've heard that. Yeah.
Now, I've had people say, I use my D104 all the time. Well, I don't understand how that works, but I'm happy that it does for them. But actually, I should mention that some of the, particularly the D104s, which is a very popular microphone for many years, since the 30s, some later models included an amplifier in the base. And you can sort of tell if that's the case. If you turn it upside down, there's a screw hole with a gain adjustment. Those microphones could actually drive just about anything. You just had to be careful you didn't overdrive by turning the gain up too high, then it wouldn't work well. But it could drive an old radio or a new one. So there's some that can go either way. Most modern microphones are designed directly to drive the 600 ohm impedance of modern transceivers. And usually there's not much of a problem with that. By the way, if you want to use a new dynamic microphone with an old radio, you can get a transformer and put it outside the microphone and transform the impedance up. And you can do the other way if you want to use an old microphone with a new radio. So it's not the end of the world. You just have to make sure you accommodate it. Now, that's a dynamic microphone. And there are a few other types you occasionally encounter. But the other one that's very frequently encountered is the electret microphone. The electret is a microphone device that is a combination of a microphone cartridge and a preamplifier built into the same little blob about the size of a kernel of corn, which makes it very handy, by the way, because it can be put into almost anything. So you find them very frequently in headset microphones, although sometimes they are dynamic as well. Most computer microphones are electrets, and many microphones that come with radio equipment is electret in nature. Now, the only thing tricky about them is that they require a DC voltage.
I was going to ask operate. You about that. Yeah.
By itself, that's not a big deal because most transceivers, recognizing that they're out there, somehow build in the capability to provide the DC to the microphone in the microphone jack. So there's a capability there, but it's not always done in the same way. In some microphone arrangements, there's just two wires coming out of the microphone, and the idea is that one of the wires is ground, the other wire is both the audio line coming out and the DC going in, and the circuitry at the radio has to separate those two so you don't put the DC in the wrong place and so forth. And then other ones have a three-wire arrangement, have a separate wire for the DC, which just needs to be hooked up to the right pin on the connector. And all of this can be adapted, but you need to be aware of it so that if you don't want to build a little adapter, you get a microphone that will work with your radio. And that's a little tricky about electrets.
Yes.
Once you have it working, in my experience, they work very well. Even these very inexpensive computer microphones people have had good luck with on the air.
Yeah, surprisingly so, yes.
I think part of that is due to the fact that we've talked a little bit about frequency response of microphones. A typical broadcast microphone, such as the one we're talking into, has a fairly flat response. And then I see you sitting at the controls and you have a whole bunch of adjustments on frequency response. So you can boost the bass or cut the bass or boost the higher frequencies or the mid-range. You have, I don't know how many, probably 8 or 10 different frequency ranges you can adjust. And you can make the sound of this flat microphone just the way you want it with your equalizer. Well, many radios now include an equalizer. And as a consequence of that, many microphone manufacturers are now making microphones that are flatter than they used to be. They used to tend to focus on raising the higher frequencies, and that was a feature to make it more articulate, to make it punch through interference and noise, so that would put the power where it was needed, as opposed to having the typical broadcast environment where it's, and some people take this to a fault, where they boost the low end to make them all sound like, what was the name of that actor that I, but anyway, real low frequency, bassy. That kind of, why can't I think of his name, but anyway, never can think of a name, I'll think of it on the way home. But
not George Takei of Star Trek, remember? He would say, oh yeah, or oh my. That's it.
I was, I'm never going to get there while we're here. Nobody wants to watch me remember.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about, I think. Our local station, the guys have it turned up so high on the low end to make them sound husky or something that I can't understand them. And I turn the bass all the way down, I still can't understand. Then the music comes on, I have to turn it back. Anyway, so you can adjust all that with your equalizer, and many radios have that built in now. But microphones used to be designed to have that happen within the microphone itself. So you'd find some people had microphones particularly designed to bust through DX pileups by having 10 or 12 dB enhancement up at the 2 kilohertz range. And it came down to how does your voice sound with that microphone, and you just had to pick one that sounded right. Well, now with an equalizer, you can actually, if you have a monitor function in your receiver, you can actually adjust the equalizer to make it sound the way you want. So you can make almost any mic sound the way you want it. So.
Exactly. Well, we have a question for the doctor, but before we do that, let's hear from DX Engineering.
All right.
We'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
All right, Joel, here's a question from Jim, KC5RUO. And he's asking, in what applications do you typically find L, T, and Pi matching networks? Do automatic antenna tuners and transceivers match the antenna system to the transceiver output using L or Pi matching networks, or do they use the T matching network as used in many manually adjusted antenna tuners? Which is it?
Well, let's start with the first part. You can find those networks in many things, starting with attenuators, because each of those configurations can be made with resistors, L's and T's and Pi's, and that's frequently used as attenuators to both attenuate a signal and maintain the same impedance. From the mid-50s until transceivers became and transmitters became solid state with broadband finals, almost every transmitter and transceiver, and these were the vacuum tube days, had a Pi network output circuit that matched the high impedance of the tube output to the typically 50 to 70 ohm impedance of the antenna system. And they're still found in virtually and probably all HF vacuum tube linear amplifiers, high power amplifiers. There's an interesting plus to that, by the way. They are adjustable generally, and therefore you can actually adjust for a slight mismatch that you can't easily do with a broadband amplifier. Hmm. Now, when we get to antenna tuners, each of those can be used as an antenna tuner configuration with various combinations of variable inductors and capacitors. Some automatic antenna tuners use, I guess they could use any kind of configuration, but I think almost all that I'm aware of use the L network topology. And I think the reason for that is the L network requires only two components, one capacitor and one inductor, and it generally requires a sort of third component, which is a switch to switch the capacitor from one end of the inductor to the other. But that's a little easier to manage, I think, particularly for an automatic tuner. And the reason is that the L network only has a single solution to match any impedance. Whereas with the T or a Pi network, you can actually move one of the capacitors a little bit one way and compensate for it with the other one. And you can find multiple solutions that provide a good match. And I would think if I were designing an algorithm for an automatic tuner, I would be much happier if I had something that just converged onto a single solution than one that could be dealt with in multiple ways. Because one thing about like the T network that has multiple possibilities, not all of them have the same efficiency. So you could get a solution, but it might not be the most efficient solution.
Before we sign off, I wanted to point out that this podcast marks our 2-year anniversary doing this.
Wow, it seems like only yesterday that we were starting this.
Yes, we started in April 2016.
Well, fortunately, neither of us has gotten any older.
Well, maybe you. But as always, Joel, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.